Sunday, 18th July 1982. A very good question was asked me just a few minutes ago whilst we were having tea. I generally define the word human as meaning the blissful creator. And is there any reason for my defining it that way? Well, I have a very good reason for it. The word human, you can split up into its suffix, hu, and the root man, man. Now, the Sanskrit root man is the sound from which our words man, mind, Sanskrit manas are all derived. In the dictionary, if you look in the big Sanskrit dictionary, the root man means, is put down as meaning to think. And the verb, the Sanskrit verb manyate, means to think as such. Now, what does all the world mean by thinking? Thinking is just silent talking. All our talk is concerned with the finite, temporal, and mortal world. It's only a string of words. When it is concerned with something other than the finite and the mortal, the words we use are negations of the finite which we know. For example, we use the word mortality and mortal because we experience death, we know what death means. And therefore, we just negate that by saying immortal to represent that which is totally beyond concepts and words. You see? Then again, there are several such instances. The prefix hu, which is interchangeable also with the prefix su, means happy in the sense of having come to fruition, to fulfillment. So now, the word human could be translated, as some might like to translate it, if they confine themselves merely to verbal philology, you see, the happy thinker. But this word man really refers to a transcendent context. We could take it into a transcendent context. Now, where thinking is concerned, we all know that whether we ascribe the creation of the universe to God or Brahman or use the word transcendence or whatever we like, we have phrases like the mind of God. Obviously, that mind certainly does not mean mind in our sense. When we use the word mind, we merely mean our psychical processes, our mental processes, as we sometimes call them, of thought and feeling, which all emerge out of the finite, temporal, and mortal context. I think some of the Hermetic writings, Hermes Trismegistus's teachings, gives a good clue to it. The thought in the mind of God is the word which is the creative word. Now, obviously, God doesn't talk in Chinese or Timbuktuan or any such language at all. the mind of God therefore means this universal cosmic creative energy which brings forth the universe. You see, the Hebrews, the Kabbalah, has the ma'amar, the sound which creates the universe. The Zarathustrians have the ahuna vairya, that is the creative word, you see, and so forth. So now, because that to me is the real meaning of the root man, and not as the dictionaries confine it, just to think in our ordinary human sense of, our ordinary everyday sense of thinking, you see, just a string of words. And hue means happy, coming to fruition. And since we always ascribe bliss, eternal bliss, we ascribe bliss to God, to the supreme creative energy, therefore to me, the word human, in its ultimate sense, in its profoundest sense, means the blissful creator. It's another way of saying what is said in Genesis, the first chapter, verses 25 and 6, that, and Elohim said, but I always prefer to translate it as, and Elohim minded, rather than said. The English word said is just what we are doing now, you see. Elohim minded. That means this creative power was used. Let us create man, not make man, as in translated in the English Bible, in our own living likeness, not image. I don't like the word image. Let us, the Bible says, let us make man in our own image. Not an image, no. Let us create man in our own living likeness. That is the primordial, paradigmatical man, if you like, as the concept in the divine mind itself. And that is why, since God is the blissful creator, so the word human really refers to us as potential blissful creators. You see? Now if the world were to, able to sort of see it in that sort of light, perhaps there might be a little change for the better. Now, it really is most worthwhile for all of us in our groups to become increasingly conscious of this fact, that the word human fundamentally means blissful creator. Because if we can become truly conscious of it, then we do become blissful creators. We shall be quite a different race of people if we could do that. And to be conscious does not mean just to hold it as an idea, as a thought. I am a human being. I am a blissful creator. Fiddlesticks creator. I do not know of a blissful creation in my life, you see. Let us grow into a full consciousness of blissful creativeness. When one has truly grown into the full consciousness of blissful creativeness, one is God walking on earth. You see, when they ascribe this divinity to Sri Krishna, or if they ascribe divinity to any of the great teachers, as gods walking the earth, it is literally true. The really accomplished yogi, the Siddha, as he is called, has this creative power in him. And as the evidence of it, he can produce certain phenomena which show that there is this something which he has, which all the rest of mortals, or more practically all the rest of mortals, do not possess. A good example, of course, also is in the miracles of Jesus, for instance. You see, and Christendom hangs its faith very much on the miraculous aspect of Jesus' work, isn't it? Now, the same applies everywhere else. With the Buddha too, he created a psychic wonder, as it is called. Now, there I think that is very sound to call it a psychic wonder, because the manifestation of this creative power in the individual is something which, when observed by the person who sees it or hears it or anything, is converted into a psychical form, a mental form in his own psyche, a thought, a feeling, an imagination, if you like. You see? And so each individual will interpret the creative act in his own way, according to his own limitations and according to his own development. So this must be borne very carefully in mind. If 1,000 people see any what is called the psychic wonder displayed by a Buddha, well, they will take 1,000 different forms altogether. But you see, to recognize our potentialities, to be able to sense them, to begin to sense them, means that one is really entering into the possibility of living religiously in the grand sense. Because whatsoever one thinks, feels, does, etc., in his finite mortal state, is a power. It's an influence, and it's a power which interacts with transcendence itself. If you can really sort of get hold of this, really grasp it, and get the inner feel of it, then you will understand why this, the mortal temporal manifestation of transcendent creativeness, when it perishes, it perishes completely and utterly. You see? But it has affected transcendence. And because the effect which I have brought about is composed of certain good things and certain not so good things, transcendence is compelled, so to say, to make another projection into the world of manifestation. It's a terrible doctrine, if you like. Terrible idea. There it is. Our responsibility is absolutely immense. And we don't realize it. If we can begin to wake up to this responsibility, our whole mode of living in the world would undergo transformation in the right direction. Because when you become really conscious of something, you know the real truth of it, it affects a change which you can hardly interpret, or other people can hardly interpret for themselves. To see a transcendent flowering in anyone needs a transcendent third eye, transcendent vision, and transcendent understanding. Then one sees that change. Otherwise, one has ideas only, which don't mean very much. Well, I think I'll stop there with that. Now, this question starts off by a little preliminary explanation. My question springs from the recent talk of Krishnamurti at the Barbican and concerns man as an image maker. It seems to me that man has a tremendous faculty for image making. and that this faculty is in a constant process of activity. When he is connected with transcendence, meaning in communion with transcendence, or whatsoever corresponds to transcendence, this faculty is at the service of transcendence. And this faculty is at the service of transcendence, the highest forms of teaching, religion and art are born. When he is connected with lesser but still high states of clarity, great art, music or literature are born. When he is not connected in any way, his image making, which proceeds involuntarily in him, produces the confused and deluded world in which he lives. He is in a state of sleep, a dreamer whom the great religious teachings call to wake up. They call the dreamer to wake up. So could one say that his dreams and his delusions are a degraded form of his faculty as blissful creator, the meaning which you give to the word human? If the above is correct, is a correct vision of image making, which includes in it the faculty of thought, then the great cathedrals, gods and religions are not put together by thought, as Krishnamurti said. They come from another source, though thought inevitably took part in their embodiment. And because they come from another source, they have the power to lead man to a state which is beyond thought. Having written all this, I now find another question which is perhaps more important. You once mentioned in a talk that man's purpose of existence is to be a bridge. And then you added, this is one of his purposes. So what are the other purposes? What are the purposes of man's existence? Now, let us start here. Krishnamurti, talking of man as an image maker. Remember that all the true spiritual religious teachers are people who bend their energies to help us to be restored to the source from which we emerged, to be completely restored to that source. It is important to remember that. We human beings on the globe, being what we are, constituted as we are, function in terms of sense impressions which we convert into thoughts, into thought forms which are but images of those impressions. We make an image of the thing, a picture of it. You may call it a mental construct. Everyone's brain is filled with mental constructs all along the line, from birth to death, you see. All right. So when we meet, particularly when we meet other human beings or think about ourselves, what we are, we raise up a mental construct of ourselves, a form, a thought form, a picture, an image. In this sense, we are image makers. I believe that is the sense in which Krishnaji uses this term with respect to human beings. Now, it is impossible to avoid this. Why? Because we are all from birth onwards conditioned, and it is impossible for any human being whatsoever, be he a Buddha or a Christ or a Firoz Mehta or a Billy Brown or whoever it is, you see, it is impossible to escape this conditioning because there are the parents around us, there is the language which is used there, there are the ways of life which constantly are taught him, and therefore that brain gets all these, the brain is the sort of library for these mental constructs. And so, every new experience as the child grows up is interpreted in terms of this library inside here. And do remember that this library inside here, in everyone's little nut, is a marvelous library. There are something like 100 trillion bits of information involved in the activity of the ordinary human brain, even that of a Ray Buckton or whoever it is, you see. 100 trillion bits. And if those bits of information are written out in the English language in précis form, they would fill 20 million volumes. Why do we buy books? We've got 20 million volumes inside here. You see? All right. So now, we cannot escape all the influence of all this. So we interpret every experience in terms of our particular library. You see? So we are image makers all the time. Our concept of ourselves, our concept, our picture which we form of those whom we love very dearly and imagine that we know very well, they are all images. And up to a point, they correspond to the reality. Only up to a small point. If what is in our vision wholly corresponds to the reality, we would see God embodied everywhere and in everything. We would. See, one has to experience this. And some people do experience it in relation to certain other people. You know how it is said of Ramana, it was said of Ramana Maharishi in India, that people who went to see him, they had all sorts of questions and arguments and whatnot, and some had, of course, blind faith in him, and others were antagonistic to some of his ideas and so forth. And in his presence, all that disturbance vanished. Vanished into nothingness. Why? For a fraction of a moment even, the person suddenly became conscious, inwardly conscious of embodied divinity. See, it's like that. So we function all the time in terms of images. But insofar as we become aware of the image and see it for what it actually is, we release a power from within our own psyche which dissolves that image into its primordial no-thingness, into its ultimate no-thingness. And in that no-thingness, the imprisoned divinity is completely revealed. And it cannot be put into concepts and words. Sometimes, you know how often I've said at our meetings, don't believe a word of what I say. Well, I mean that, you see. Don't believe a word that I say, every word that I say. Simply because any word said by anybody is interpreted by a conditioned brain and makes an image, a thought form, which is not like the perfect picture of a creative artist in the great sense. It is not the perfect reality there. So much for this image-making aspect in us and the way it functions and so forth. It seems to me that man has a tremendous faculty for image-making. Yes, quite true. The very word imagination means image-making. And that this faculty is in constant process of activity. Yes, we can't help it. Simply because our psyche, being what it is, it will function that way all along the line until we wake up to what is happening. It may be compared to somebody cooking, you see, and forgetting to turn the gas off when the telephone bell goes, and the long conversation ensues, and suddenly the smell of burnt food wakes that person up, you see, to what is happening. It's a bit like that. Now, if this faculty is at the service of transcendence, the highest form of teaching, religion and art are born. This is also true, but in a curious way. The image making faculty usually is something which distorts the perfect clarity and perfection of the reality. It distorts it. But if that person happens to be gifted in a certain way, a Bach or Beethoven, Shakespeare or Homer or whoever it is, you see, somebody like that, the impressions which he receives through the senses and the experiences in life which he undergoes can experience a complete transmutation in his own, in the deeps of his own consciousness. And when that transmutation takes place, he is able to reproduce the transmutation in terms of perfect art or of profound religious truths or really deep and successful philosophical ideas or scientific facts and so on. You take, for instance, this sort of phenomenon. How some people, if say they are composers, when they express grief or something like that, you do hear really doleful music. You get somebody like a Chopin or a Beethoven or a Bach or a Brahms, you do not get just a doleful expression. You get the transmutation of it. One of the finest instances of that which I know of is in the last quartets of Beethoven, and in the Missa Solemnis, the Sanctus and the Benedictus. There is a case of a wonderful transmutation of all that life experience, the pain, the sorrow, the grief, the fleeting joys and all the rest of it, expressed in a transcendental perfection. You see? Now it's the same with great poets too. They can do that. It happens with them. And some philosophers, not all. Philosophers too often just philosophize. They are philosophists, not philosophers, you see. So, this transmutation can take place. Now, when this transmutation takes place, and it takes form and comes out in art or whatever it is, religious teaching or anything, in a form which is unmistakably transcendental, then imagination, the person's own imagination, is at the service of transcendence. Otherwise it isn't. Too many people imagine, believe, they are conceited enough to believe that they are the servants of God. And I mean, I have heard an eminent Dutch philosopher, this is years ago in the 1950s at a conference, say openly, I assure you, God spoke to me, you see, and told me this, that, and the other. And the stuff which came out of his mouth was not worth the paper on which it was scribbled. It's like that. You have to be very, very careful about these things. It's extremely easy to fall into this trap. It is true that the statement, I am God, is an absolute fact in the context of the absolute, but not in my mortal, temporal, finite context. This has to be borne in mind very, very carefully. This horrible pride and conceit and egoism and vanity with which we are cursed plays the devil with us in our religious life and growth. So you have to be very, very careful. And in this question, I think it would be more helpful, it would be wiser, not to think in terms of grades of communion. When he's connected with lesser but still high states of clarity, great art, musical literature come out and so forth. How can I measure the lessness or the higherness of my state of clarity? What are the means of measurement? Measurement does not exist in the context of the transcendent. The transcendent is a context of totality. It's a context of absoluteness. There are no differences. I, the limited, finite, temporal, mortal, am the one who produces comparisons and differences and measurements and so forth. I am the splitter up of the unity of the universe. This is my fundamental sin. You see, and this is the real meaning, I'm sure, of the original Catholic teaching. Man is born a sinner. Because his consciousness separates himself from the totality. That is the fundamental sin, the fundamental crime, which makes us certainly subhuman as a whole species, and in so many individual instances so utterly bestial, inhuman creatures. You see? So these things have to be understood and borne in mind. Still, I know what the questioner is implying, that there are states in which we are in a mood of exaltation or ecstasy, calmly, and so forth, and in those states, inspiration comes through. That is true. But when he is not connected in communion in any way with transcendence, his image making, which proceeds involuntarily in him, which is perfectly true, produces the confused and deluded world in which he lives. This is true, but there never is a fraction of a moment even in which any human creature is not in communion or connection with transcendence. Look, it's a little bit like this. Where are we at this moment? We would say, oh, in this room, and we'll say at 9 Westbourne Drive. Yes. But where is 9 Westbourne Drive? Oh, it's in London. Where is London? Oh, it's in England. Where is England? It's in the world. Where is the world? Oh, it's in space. Space. But there is space in this room. Huh? We are all the time in space. There's not a thing material or immaterial a human, a perfected being, a beast, a devil, or anyone who is not, who is completely out of touch with transcendence. Because the totality of manifestation is transcendence embodied. But it can be hidden over, it can be imprisoned, it can be crushed down. That can happen, you see. And only in that sense can it be said that we are out of communion. But unfortunately, that sense, this out of communionness is so tremendous that the misery and the sorrow of the world, individually, nationally, internationally, and so on, goes on. The horror of the world's busyness goes on. He is in a state of sleep. Yes. The sleep of the person who is poisoned with narcotics. He is poisoned. He's dead drunk. And that's why all these things happen. So could one say that his dreams and his delusions are a degraded form of his faculty as blissful creator? I shouldn't quite say as are degraded forms of his faculty as blissful creator. They are the sort of unhealthy excrescences out of the impure psyche. I would put it that way. Now, this other question, that one of the purposes of man, I said some time back, was to be a bridge between this, which is the imperfect, the unfulfilled, the not come to fruition, between this and that, the transcendent itself, you see. All right. That is one of his purposes, true. Also, one must remember that the transcendent primordial creative energy plus the pure consciousness at work, the absolute consciousness at work, produces grades and grades of being of which we are unaware. And they function at a cosmic level, on a universal scale. Now, whatever takes place in our limited world, as individuals, in our small way, gets a touch with the cosmic counterpart of it. You see, there is a cosmic counterpart of it. That is why you find in the religious philosophies of the world, gods and devils, suras and asuras, and the constructive agencies and the destructive agencies and so forth, as we call them. Rather than destructive agencies, I would rather say the agencies which dissolve, bring about the dissolution of that which is outworn or against the stream of evolution and so forth. You see? Put it that way and it will be better. Because the word destruction is associated, in our brains at least, with the idea of annihilation. Nothing is annihilated. The totality of the universe is continuously being transformed, being transmuted all the time. Of course, the so-called practical, hard-headed man of the world, the scientist, the rather materialistic scientist and so forth, will say, oh, this man's a crazy idealist. All right, I am a crazy idealist. So what? Do I do more harm or less harm than many non-crazy, non-idealists? It's that sort of situation. So, we are the instruments, we can be the instruments of these cosmic agencies at work. And in fact, practically every one of us is without knowing it. You take the case of people like the great conquerors, Alexander, Napoleon, people like Hitler and the whole crowd of them, you see, strutting on the world stage, the superb vain egotists which the world has produced. Well, they are the agents of that aspect of the cosmic energy which is concerned with the dissolution of that which is not wanted. They are the instruments of waste paper basket material. And of course, as such, deserve compassion. Not so much deserve as it is right and proper to have to view them compassionately and with understanding. Because if we do not view all of them with compassion and understanding, we do not generate any energy which would dissolve away the evil which is embodied there. We cannot transform it. You see, it's like that. So that is another of the purposes. And of course, there are the out-and-out factual purposes of each individual's existence, the preservation of himself and of the species, which involves food and sex. See that everything to do with food and sex is done purely, honestly, perfectly, beautifully, straightforwardly, without unnecessarily upsetting the social order and all the rest of it. See? And in that way we have our purposes fulfilled.